Today is Tuesday, February 18th. We're going to start on page 45. At the very top there, you'll notice that we're looking at regulating heart rate. And I want to make a point about that for just a moment. On the previous page, when we talked about preload, contractility, afterload, you'll notice there's a bunch of factors listed there that will influence how, to what degree your heart wall stretches, which is preload. We looked at factors that influence how hard your heart beats or with what strength it beats, that is contractility. And we also looked at things that can influence your afterload. On this page, however, 45, we're looking at things that influence your heart rate. And so normal resting heart rate is about how many beats per minute?
75,
good. So if you're looking at just a regular heart, not an athletic, well-toned heart, then we know that in order to pump blood efficiently to our body, we must look at an ejection fraction somewhere in that 50 to 65% range, and that we're looking at stroke volumes around 70 milliliters and an end diastolic volume of around 120. What this means for us is that the heart rate will influence how much blood you pump out into circulation. If your heart is beating really slow, what do we worry about for your cells and tissues? Oxygen starvation, right. And what if your heart's beating too fast and you're not actually exercising? Same problem. Maybe you're not getting enough oxygen out to your cells and tissues. So the real issue here is that heart rate is going to ultimately influence how much oxygen your cells and tissues get. And a slow heart rate may not do the job in delivering enough, and a fast heart rate may wear the heart out. So you'll see this is a huge list of things on this page that have to do with influencing overall heart rate. Okay, so at the very top of your page, let me also draw your attention back to cardiac output. CO is cardiac output. It is equal to two factors. Heart rate is, of course, one of them, stroke volume being the second one. So on average, what is the cardiac output for a typical human body? How many liters per minute? Yeah, 5 liters per minute. So ultimately, we're influencing that delivery of oxygenated blood to cells and tissues. We're looking at normally about 5 liters of blood circulated through the body per minute. Okay, so first thing here is sympathetic nervous system stimulation. We know the heart has its own built-in nervous system. That built-in nervous system is called the intrinsic conduction system. Or you can call it the cardiac conduction system. How fast does that built-in nervous system set the heart rate? 75 beats per minute, right. There are all sorts of things that can cause this sympathetic nervous system to kick in and say, hey, 75 beats per minute's not cutting it. Let's crank it up to 100, 125, 150 beats per minute, even 200 beats per minute. So what kind of situation might you be in that you'll see your heart rate start to increase thanks to the sympathetic nervous system?
You're scared.
Scared. What else?
Exercise.
Anything stress. That puts you in stress. Yeah, fight or flight, right? So fight or flight response will put you into sympathetic mode. You're right, that could be the E words like emergency, exercise, excitement. Those kinds of things will activate the sympathetic nervous system and cause it to override your intrinsic conduction system. So no longer does your heart get to set the pace at 75 beats. The heart rate is overridden by this external system, the sympathetic nervous system. So we know from Bio-210, there's other reaching effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine. But for now, we'll just focus on the fact that it causes your heart rate to increase. And we'll learn in the next chapter, it also makes your blood vessels constrict. Okay, so epinephrine and norepinephrine behave as both neurotransmitters and as hormones. And if they're hormones, they travel how?
Bloodstream,
right. So their lingering effects may take 30 minutes or longer to get out of your body. If those hormones travel your bloodstream, your liver has to break down those hormones. So even 30 minutes after a good scare, you're still getting rid of all that epinephrine that's in your bloodstream. So, you know, you go home from work stressed, you don't just cut it off, right? You know, it takes sometimes hours to decompress yourself after you've had a stressful day. All right, so I just want to mention these receptors here. They're not on your worksheet, but they're interesting because they tie us back into Bio-210. You may have learned in Bio-210 about alpha receptors and beta receptors. These receptors bind neurotransmitters and hormones like epinephrine and norepinephrine. So the way that your heart becomes excited, thanks to epinephrine and norepinephrine, is those kinds of hormones or neurotransmitters will bind beta receptors, okay? So if you have a beta blocker in your system, that drug blocks the beta receptor. What that means is you've put a plug on that receptor and you say, hey, epinephrine and norepinephrine, keep on traveling. You don't have any business with this cell. So what happens to heart rate if you take a beta blocker? Slows it down, right. And that may be the intended goal, which is to slow down that heart rate. Okay, so we talked about epinephrine and norepinephrine. Let's talk about thyroxine as another hormone that influences heart rate. What is thyroxine's major job in your body?
Metabolism,
right. And that includes heart metabolism. So if present, thyroxine will tell your heart cells to increase their metabolic rate. And in fact, that can increase your heart rate. We talked about glucagon on the previous page when we dealt with the preload, contractility, and afterload. It was specifically mentioned there for contractility. That is the strength of the heart contraction. Glucagon is an antagonist to insulin. What do those two hormones regulate? Blood sugar, blood glucose, right. So what effect does glucagon have on blood sugar?
Increase
it, right. So of course, you know, the more glucagon you've got, the higher or faster that heart rate can go. So we don't need more sugar in our systems. That just jacks up the heart rate. Okay, let's talk about ions for just a moment. Back in Bio-210, you probably learned about the role of sodium and potassium. What did they help a cell maintain, like a muscle cell or a nerve cell? Action potential, resting states. So wherever they're located, either makes your cell get excited or it makes your cell stay at rest. There was a third ion you talked about back in that class, and that was calcium. And so calcium played a big role, especially inside those muscle cells. What does calcium do in this picture of troponin and tropomyosin? It is what? Yeah, it moves those tropomyosin ropes, which are like blindfolds. And when it moves them out of the way, what does it reveal on the actin filament?
Binding site.
Binding site. Good, for the myosin heads. And once you reveal the binding sites for the myosin heads, what do those myosin heads take advantage of and do?
Make cross bridges and power strokes.
Cross bridge and power stroke. So that makes your muscle cells
contract,
yeah. So the more calcium you've got, the more contraction you can have in a muscle cell. That goes for heart muscle just like it goes for skeletal muscle. So there's three really important ions here. There's sodium, potassium, and calcium. Sodium and potassium maintain resting state or action potential. Calcium helps with the muscle contraction. How about questions so far? Okay, so let's go back and look at this. Too much calcium, which is hypercalcemia, can lead to cases where you've got abnormal heart rhythms. It also increases contractility, like we found on the previous page, which means that we're increasing the strength of the contraction. So if a person has really strong heartbeats, maybe it's beating arrhythmically or fast, then we may have to do a blood test to see if they've got extra calcium in the bloodstream. If we do have extra blood calcium, there's a couple of hormones we might start looking at. Which two help regulate blood calcium levels?
Calcitonin and PTH.
Yeah, calcitonin and PTH. And which one raises blood calcium?
PTH.
So it may in fact be that one that's causing the problems. Okay. Likewise, you'll notice here low potassium is known as hypokalemia. Hey, catch the spelling here. Calcemia and kalemia look a lot alike. except calcemia's got calcium. Kalemia's got the K, which reminds us of K, symbol for potassium. Just a minor detail, but it makes all the difference in terms of which disorder you're talking about. So this low potassium issue can cause the heart to be hyperexcitable. Let's go back to BIO210 for just a moment. When your heart was in a resting state, where was potassium?
Inside.
And where was sodium?
Outside.
So when you have less potassium inside, what happens to your negative 70 or whatever resting state? Maybe your negative 60. What happens when you get closer to negative 55?
Action potential.
Yeah, you've hit threshold. So if you don't have enough potassium to maintain a really strong negative resting state inside your cell, and you're slipping down toward, you know, negative 55 or that threshold value, boom, you can have hearts that are more excitable and much more likely to cause a heartbeat. And that's because we don't have enough potassium to maintain that polarity between the outside charge and the inside charge. So having little amounts of potassium can be deadly for us. It can make the heart super excitable, just as well as having not enough potassium. Too much potassium can also be an issue for us. So too little potassium here, hypokalemia, can make the heart beat more rhythmically, faster, makes it hyper excitable, meaning that it's more likely to jump into the threshold and action potential range. You'll notice also on your sheet there, fever and caffeine can also increase heart rate. That's probably no surprise. If you've ever had a bad fever, you probably have felt your heart beat out of your chest and faster than normal. That heat increases the metabolic rate, and the fever, of course, does the same on the heart tissue. Caffeine is a stimulant. There's other stimulants out there, but this is a great one. It's a commonly accessible drug, and it will increase heart rate. All right, let's flip the tables and do what will slow heart rate down. Okay, so at the bottom of your page, parasympathetic activity is actually the dominating system for heart rate. And because it's the dominating system, it controls heart rate by lowering it, and it does so through a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And that's your blank down there, about halfway down the page. Promotes the release of acetylcholine. So leave the heart by itself, and the intrinsic conduction system sets a heart rate of 75 beats per minute. But if you have an outside influence coming from the parasympathetic nervous system, what happens to that heart rate? Slows it down. So what are some activities you can do to slow your heart rate?
Eat a bunch.
Yeah, eat a big turkey meal at Thanksgiving, right? How do you feel after a big meal?
Dead.
Yeah, sleepy like a slug. You're going to get in the bed and sleep it off, right? Time to hibernate. So that puts you into a great parasympathetic mode. It's that rest and digest mode. What are some other things that you can do or practice that will put you into parasympathetic mode?
Usaha breathing.
Yeah, if you can breathe and control your breathing and focus and yoga and meditation and relaxation techniques, these all take you out of sympathetic mode and force you into parasympathetic mode. And it gets rid of which neurotransmitters and hormones? Which ones jack you up?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine. And we're hoping to get parasympathetic in control with which neurotransmitter?
ACH.
ACH, right. So ACH, we know, is a muscle neurotransmitter. And on the heart, it specifically makes your heart slow down. So parasympathetic control is actually the ideal mode for your heart. It doesn't wear out your heart muscle tissue. So let's talk about vagus nerve tone, because it is the main worker for your parasympathetic nervous system. The vagus nerve is an unusual cranial nerve. It is cranial nerve number 10, and it's unusual because it wanders away from your brain. Most cranial nerves serve something around your head and don't necessarily wander away from your head. That's why it's called the Wanderer. Vagus means the Wanderer. And in fact, it travels down as far as your bladder or your reproductive organs for both males and females. Our focus right now is on the heart. And if you are putting mind over matter and trying to relax yourself, the vagus nerve overrides the SA node's firing rate and slows it down. And so we're looking at perhaps slowing it below 75 beats per minute. You'll notice there on your sheet that vagal tone is the effect of the vagus nerve on the heart rate. It normally affects a slower heart rate. That's the job of the vagus nerve, to slow the heart rate. What if you have a patient who's had some heart tissue damage and that SA node is not firing as fast as it should be? Well, then we've got a number two in charge, right? We've got that AV node, which would set a pace of 40 to 60 beats per minute. But let's say that the SA node is still faster than that. Maybe it's doing, say, 60, 65 beats per minute. What's the vagus nerve going to tell that SA node to do?
Slow it down.
So it may slow it below what it is barely functioning to do in the first place. The bad news here is that if you're slowing down this heart rate and you don't have a strong heart in the first place, what happens to your oxygen delivery?
Goes down,
right? So what happens to your, you know, your brain, your cells and tissues and your fingers and toes?
They don't get enough.
So dizziness, lightheadedness, cold fingers, cold toes. So unfortunately, the vagus nerve can override that heart rate and slow it, even when we don't need it to be slower than it already is. So if that's the case, we have a drug here called atropine, and atropine will increase heart rate, and that's good in case you have somebody whose SA node may not be doing its job and maintaining that 75 beats per minute, or in the case where you've got a vagal nerve that is overactive and overstimulating that SA node to slow down. Let me focus on a word here. If you overstimulate the vagus nerve, you know, you're not making yourself more excitable, you're actually making your heart rate go where?
Down.
So when I say overstimulate the vagus nerve, you've got to really think about, okay, so what is the vagus nerve's job? It slows heart rate. So if I really overstimulate the vagus nerve, it's going to really slow down that heart rate. So in the case where the vagus nerve is overstimulated, some people may need atropine to help bring up and maintain a normal resting heart rate. You'll notice a couple of other terms there. Vasovagal syncope or syncope is actually the most common cause of fainting. That means that somebody may have an overactive vagus nerve. Perhaps it's being overstimulated for whatever reason. Okay. And then likewise, the Valsalva maneuver or vagal maneuver. I do want to mention this. So take a moment and appreciate where all this vagus nerve wanders. It goes to the heart, the lungs. Look at all these digestive organs that are innervated by it. It even goes down as far as the kidneys, the bladder, reproductive organs. So that vagus nerve travels all over your digestive and your thoracic cavity organs. Now, if you happen to hold your breath, you can stimulate the vagus nerve.
30 seconds or longer. They had us do that for panic attacks.
Oh, yeah. Hold it and breathe it. Yeah, get it down, right? So what do you do if you're holding your breath for 30 seconds or longer to that vagus nerve? You say, vagus nerve, you're in control. You get stimulated. And now where does your heart rate and your blood pressure go? Slower and slower. So it's not, like you said, it's not 5 or 10 seconds of holding your breath. It's a honest to goodness, hold your breath for as long as you can, and that will stimulate the vagus nerve. Likewise, if you cough really hard, they say that can also do the same job as holding your breath. But yeah, you're going to have to do a really hearty bellowing cough to get it to do that. But nonetheless, if somebody is, panicking, fast heart rate, high blood pressure, simply holding the breath for about, 15, 30 seconds or longer is going to stimulate that vagus nerve and release acetylcholine onto the SA node. And when we do that, where does the heart rate go?
Slower,
right. So I mention this to you because of one particular reason. Old people get constipated. Young people get constipated. But the really dangerous combination if you have an elderly person who's constipated and taking heart rate medication. Now you've got a problem because you've got someone holding their breath to have a bowel movement.
Faint and fall off
the toilet. Right.
Great.
Yeah. So if you take a beta blocker or something like that that already slows your heart rate and you're holding your breath trying to push out a bowel movement, vagus nerve says partay, right? And where does that heart rate go? Down. It can drop so low that you're right. People faint, they pass out, they fall off the toilet.
That's humiliating.
They say this is how Elvis went. That's awful. Was she on this concoction of medication? Yeah.
That's horrible. That's embarrassing.
Yep. I hear that a lot of calls from nursing homes are for that very purpose. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes. So. If they come into an emergency room like that, they would have just, they was in the bathroom, that's how they found them.
Yeah.
It's because they fainted because they were trying to go and
fell off the floor and hit their head.
Yep.
Bathtub.
Yep. Fall, yeah, I mean, and if they can take some kind of stool softener, then great. That helps that bowel movement come without having to hold the breath for so long. So you probably have never given thought to this, but when you have a bowel movement, you actually hold your breath, and you do so until you can increase the pressure and push out the bowel movement. And you may have caught yourself feeling a bit lightheaded at times, not even realizing that you were holding your breath for all that time. You also do this Valsalva maneuver when you lean over and pick up stuff off the floor. If you were to drop your pencil on the floor right now, you would not realize it, but you're holding your breath to create abdominal pressure that allows you to pick up your pencil and then sit back up. Now, next time you drop something, you'll think about that Valsalva's maneuver. Every time you pick up something, whether it's a heavy box, things off the floor, pushing out a bowel movement, this Valsalva's maneuver is triggered. You do it so often and so not consciously that you don't even realize you're holding your breath. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately, it can be for too long. So the name of this trick is a Valsalva maneuver or vagal maneuver. It is simply holding your breath until you activate that vagus nerve. And when you do that, what happens to heart rate? Decreases. Okay, so in terms of ions, we're again talking about sodium, potassium, and calcium. Sodium's not really a huge issue here, but potassium and calcium are. Hypocalcemia is a condition of low blood calcium. That can cause heart arrhythmias. So low blood calcium, high blood calcium can cause dangerous territory for the heart rate. Notice it is opposite to the other condition we just talked about, hypercalcemia. Let's talk about this one here. Hyperkalemia, high potassium levels, can cause such fatal arrhythmias that a person's heart may stop. This is bad news to have potassium imbalances. When we hear about potassium and calcium imbalances, we're looking at serious business for the heart because low calcium and high potassium can cause a real mess for your heart, lowering that heart rate. Okay, so if you've ever had a pet put to sleep, they use potassium chloride. It stops the heart. When people are put to death, they use potassium chloride. It stops the heart. So potassium is such a big deal because it does influence that resting heart rate. Big picture here. Which hormone regulates potassium? Same one that regulates sodium. Aldosterone. Yeah, this one's aldosterone. So any aldosterone imbalances ultimately can lead to potassium and or sodium issues. The real issue though for the heart is that potassium imbalance. So at the very bottom of your page, just a little summary here of some medications that influence heart rate. Beta blockers, alpha blockers, and calcium channel blockers all lower the heart rate. They just do it in different ways. We just covered the beta blocker. It blocks epinephrine and norepinephrine. Alpha blockers tend to make the heart relax, and the mechanism's more complicated than we want to get into in this class. And calcium channel blockers do exactly what their name implies. They block calcium from entering the heart. If you block calcium from entering the heart, you're promoting this case of hypocalcemia, which may be needed to make the heart rate slow down. So we're looking at beta blockers for epinephrine and norepinephrine slowing their effects, and calcium channel blockers blocking the effects of calcium. This is a heavy-duty page of information. Is there anything here that I can go back and hit for you one more time? Okay, so let me take you back to just one thought before we leave this behind. And that is this thought. Anything that influences heart rate, which is the focus of this page, is going to influence your cardiac output. If you speed your heart rate, you're going to increase your cardiac output. If you decrease your heart rate, you're going to decrease your cardiac output. And we said on average for a resting adult, we're looking at about how many liters of blood circulated per minute? About five. So anything on this page that influences heart rate ultimately influences your capability for delivering oxygen to cells and tissues. All right, so the other factor there was stroke volume, and we covered some of those influencers back on the previous page, page 44. All right, so how about questions so far on anything page 44, 45, anything I can hit again for you? Any topic you want to run back through? Okay. Just a little bit left here, page 46. Well, hearts are like rubber bands. They should be elastic, they should be stretchy, they should have good contractility. Meaning what?
Snap back,
right. So you've got the stretch and you've got the strength of snap back. Unfortunately, if we have heart damage, then we lose that contractility, we lose that stretchy snap back that we expect of a fresh, healthy rubber band. So hearts are like rubber bands. You know, if you've got a 20-year-old rubber band, they become brittle and not so stretchy. And that stretchiness, when it wears out, becomes a real problem. In fact, if heart tissue becomes flabby and stretched and it loses that snapback ability, then we end up with disorder called chronic or congestive CHF heart failure. So CHF goes for either chronic or congestive. Unfortunately, chronic means what? It's no cure. It's just a condition you live with, right? And congestive heart failure, this is a problem that will cause our bodies to eventually take on extra fluids. And we'll explore that in just a moment. So here's some things that can lead to your heart becoming less elastic. Coronary atherosclerosis is a mouthful. What is coronary?
Of the heart.
Of the heart. What does sclerosis mean?
Hardening.
Hardening. So these vessels around the heart are actually hardening. And if that happens to a person, then they no longer can stretch as blood flows through the vessels to the heart muscle and then contract and snap back when necessary. High blood pressure can wear out your heart and your blood vessels. We'll talk about that in the next chapter. Multiple heart attacks. What does this do to the myocardial tissue?
Damages
it, right. And what do we replace damaged heart muscle tissue with? Collagen, yes, scar tissue. So that doesn't stretch and snap back. And then dilated cardiomyopathy means what's overall happened to the heart itself?
Stretched out.
I do want to make a point here. If someone is an Olympic-type athlete and is very well exercised, they're going to have an enlarged heart because the heart muscle tissue becomes thicker and stronger, just like any muscle would, and it's going to allow for efficient contractility. But if that's not the case and we have somebody who's got maybe multiple heart attacks in their history, dilated cardiomyopathy is not good news. It just simply means, like a bad pair of stretched out underwear, it is stretched and it will not snap back. So think of underwear. You don't want to have the kind that's flabby and has lost its tone. So we want it to be able to contract and reduce the blood out of the heart. Okay, so if you happen to have what's called left side heart failure, that means the left ventricle is unable to pump the blood as it should. So go backwards with me. If the left ventricle's not pumping as it should, it's big and flabby, then blood has an opportunity to backflow. Go backwards with me. Where is it coming from? Left atrium. And the left atrium gets blood from the lungs. Just backwards. Just go in the backtrack route. If you backflow blood to the lungs, you get things like pulmonary congestion, like fluid on the lungs, and edema, swelling of the lungs. People feel like they can't catch their breath. They feel like they're suffocating. So if you have an inefficient left ventricle, just back it up to the lungs, and we start seeing fluids accumulate there on the lungs. Let's talk about right side heart failure. If that right ventricle cannot effectively pump blood out, backflow it with me, go backwards to the right atrium. And where does the right atrium get blood from? Yeah, SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. I'm standing, you're sitting, we're not upside down, so we're probably not backflowing blood to the SVC, right? So where are you probably sending that blood?
Legs.
Legs, yep. So IVC gets the backflow, legs and arms get it, especially legs. That's a long way to pump back to the heart, right? So we're looking at excess fluids being backed up into circulation. So we see things like, you know, peripheral edema. People have rings, watches, jewelry that's tight, their hands are swollen, their socks cut into their legs. They see an indentation when they take their socks off. These kinds of things may be an indicator that we've got fluid pooling in our extremities. So in this case, it's called not pulmonary, but peripheral congestion and peripheral edema. Here's the bad news. Given time, these two conditions will coincide. And what I mean by that is if you start with left side heart failure, the right side's doing all it can to pump, and it finally says, I just give up, I can't handle it. So it begins to fail. Or if the right side is failing, the left side says, you know, I'll try to do all I can and pump, and eventually it too begins to fail. So what may start as a left or a right side failure will ultimately be an entire heart failure. And that's bad news for somebody. I do want to point out what you see in both of these pictures. This one and the previous one has this swollen belly here called ascites. If we have heart problems and the heart cannot effectively pump blood, then fluids tend to accumulate, especially in the belly region. So we're not talking about fat in the belly. We're actually talking about fluid that accumulates there. So that fluid accumulation condition is called ascites. Okay, so you can see it here. And you can see it in the next picture. All right, so treatment for this on your worksheet, things like diuretics, blood pressure drugs. We're looking at digitalis to increase the strength of contraction. And worst case scenario would be requiring a heart transplant for this condition. All right, how about questions on page 46? What do people get confused about this page? It's backtracking the blood to the appropriate place. Keep in mind, left side heart failure sends fluid into the lungs. Where does right side heart failure send fluid? To the body. So we're backwards, we're going backwards in that flow pathway. That's commonly confused on tests. Last little bit here is on page 47. Question, go ahead. Sure. People commonly confuse where the problem arises. Left side heart failure makes fluid accumulate in the lungs. What's that?
The L's.
The L's, that's right. Yeah, the left in the lungs. And the right side goes to the body. That's a good way to do it. So, think in blood flow, but you've got to go the backwards path. Yeah. if I heard you correctly, the swelling in the ankles is, yeah, it's right side heart failure, or it can be just a whole heart that's failing. So if the muscle tissue in there is flabby and weak, it just can't pump blood properly, so we can't circulate that fluid off the ankles.
Is that what lymphedema is?
That specifically is proteins that escape the blood circulation, and they're now hanging out in your cells and tissues. You will never get those proteins back, so that's a chronic problem of having proteins pull fluid out into your cells and tissues. But that accumulation of lymph without the proteins could in fact be chronic heart failure.
Okay.
Yeah. How about other questions? So let's talk about heart attacks for just a moment. The fancy word for heart attack, as you probably know, is myocardial infarction, or MI for short. And this is a long-term oxygen deprivation setup for your heart muscle tissue. Uh-oh, if you damage heart muscle tissue, you don't replace it, right? What fills in that area of dead tissue?
Collagen.
And that's scar tissue. So that means that we may damage that circuitry of the intrinsic conduction system. By contrast, you'll notice that angina pectoris is not a long-term damage, it's a short-term deprivation of oxygen. People often can't discriminate between the two. Angina gives a person chest pain, so does a heart attack. So it requires being able to diagnose one and not, you know, eliminate the other one. So some things that can cause angina might be exercise or climbing stairs. It's a fleeting heart pain, it comes and goes. But we don't want to ignore that because it may be signs of something else that's looming on the horizon, like a heart attack. So having stress tests or having a cardiologist check you out would help, you know, us eliminate, you know, that it's just angina and not, you know, a looming heart attack problem. So let's talk about heart attack symptoms or myocardial symptoms for just a moment. These heart attack symptoms here are mainly for males. So these are classic male heart attack symptoms. You'll notice they're what we always hear. Chest pain, crushing chest pain, left arm pain, which is referred pain, left jaw pain, also referred pain, shortness of breath. And you'll notice the other symptoms there. Cold sweat, nausea, and lightheadedness. Let me mention that for just a moment. Which nervous system, sympathetic or parasympathetic, tries to dominate your heart rate? So if you've got, say, a heart attack going on, parasympathetic says, hey, I'll try to help. And so
dial it down.
Dial it down, right? And so if you've got parasympathetic all of a sudden trying to work, then there comes this nausea or this, like, maybe vomiting kind of thing that comes from this. So it's parasympathetic trying to play a role in fixing what's going wrong with the heart. So clamminess, nausea, these are things that come with the flu, right? So sometimes people get these symptoms and they say, well, you know, I've got this pain in my chest, but I feel like I've got the flu coming on, and they ignore it. And that's, of course, not what we want to do if we've got symptoms like this that are lining up together. Women's heart attack symptoms may be entirely different. How might a woman feel when she's having a heart attack?
Tired.
More tired than she's ever felt, like bone-numbing exhaustion. Okay, what else?
Backache.
Could have a backache. You know, the heart sits about here in the front, and if you just draw a line back through to the back, she may feel pain like somebody's stabbing her in the back. You know, right through the back of the heart, you know, on the back side. What's that?
Shoulder pain.
Shoulder pain, yep. She'll say, I slept funny, it's okay, right? Okay, what else? Maybe some breathlessness, okay? So she may have the clenching chest pain that feels like an elephant sitting on her chest. She may not. So if she has back pain and extremely tired, she may think, I pulled something. I did something funny. I moved wrong. I slept funny. And excuse this, you know, kind of warning sign that she's got going on. I had a student, she was in her 50s in my class several years ago, and we were talking about the difference between male and female heart attack symptoms, and she had a rolling book bag, and back when the third floor walkway was open, she said that she was winded by the time she got up here to the fourth floor. And so she started listening to this, and she says, "And you know, I don't know what's going on, but this scares me." And she had not said anything to me at that time. She disappeared from my class. It was, I believe, a summer semester. And I noticed that she withdrew from my roster. She was passing the course at that point, you know, which is kind of odd for somebody to disappear. And so I saw her later that fall semester. She was back on campus. The discussion we had scared her bad enough that she went and got an appointment, had a stress test done, had a three-way bypass done. Yeah. So I'm so thankful that she was in class to hear that conversation. She was walking around with this looming on her future. So when she came back to class, she shared her story with the class. She cried. She said that conversation made the difference for her. So, you know, I hope that if you have a woman or a man in your life, especially women, because they have these strange symptoms, you know, pay attention to these weird things. Don't scream heart attack at you, right? So these kinds of women heart attack symptoms are different than men's heart attack symptoms. Women are more likely to say, "Oh, it's just whatever. It's the flu. It's I pulled something," and excuse the symptoms and walk away from it.
So I told my mom that she had had two heart attacks.
Wow.
Small ones.
Had she
went to the cardiologist for the first time.
Any symptoms?
All those kind of crazy
oh,
symptoms.
Oh, wow.
But she was a nurse, and she just pushed through.
Which you would think nurses.
She thought she was tired because of working so many hours.
See,
this was back when she was 55, 56.
Wow. I mean, and there again, we excuse the symptoms and say, "Oh, it's just, you know, something else is going on." So, yep. So, just wanted to mention that, you know, again, if it's just fleeting chest pain, we don't know if it's angina or if it's this without really testing to see if there's some chemical damage done to the heart. You'll notice in your course pack, near the top, troponin and CK are two muscle damage tests. You'll notice that troponin is used to diagnose a heart attack because it differentiates between angina and a full-on myocardial infarction. CK can detect any muscle tissue damage, and it's not specific to heart muscle tissue. So if you have CK in the bloodstream, it could mean that you were, you know, lifting weights over the weekend or doing some heavy-duty lifting in your yard. So CK is not a discriminator between heart muscle and skeletal muscle. It just says muscle tissue damage in general. All righty. Last little bit on this page. Hey, that was my public service announcement for the day, right? Bottom of the page, two holes in the heart and a fetus, not yet born. One is foramen ovale and the other is ductus arteriosus. These are present in a fetal circulation because fetuses don't breathe oxygen. They breathe it through the blood from the mom. So as a fetus, they get blood flowing through the right atrium to the left atrium. That's what the purpose of the foramen ovale is. And ductus arteriosus takes blood directly from aorta to pulmonary trunk. There's a connection between those two. Upon birth, babies then have to breathe air and no longer get the oxygen from the mom. So these two holes should close up. We expect to see foramen ovale become fossa ovalis. You can see that as a little thumbprint in the right atrium of the heart where that hole once existed. What does ductus arteriosus become? Ligamentum arteriosum. And where is it found between what two vessels? Yeah, pulmonary trunk and aorta. So it's that little white tissue that's between those two vessels. Okay, so the holes are only present during the fetal time period after birth. We should expect to see these holes close and, of course, no longer allow that bypassing or shunting of blood. So people can have conditions where these fetal bypasses stay open. You'll notice that if a person has a defect in the heart called an interatrial septal defect, then blood can flow directly from the right atrium to the left atrium. Uh-oh, that's not good news, because what are you now mixing?
Oxygenated
and deoxygenated blood. And another issue could be a patent ductus arteriosus, meaning that opening between the pulmonary trunk and the aorta stays open. Still the same problem, right? You're still mixing oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. So sometimes people have things like migraines or worse yet, strokes, if these little openings continue to stay open past birth or, you know, first year of life. All right, so that should take you down to the bottom of 47. And you know what? That is the end of this chapter. So as you study, if you come upon something that you'd like to hear again, let me know. We'll stop, you know, at the beginning of class and do some review on that topic before we head on into new territory. The last little bit we're going to cover today is some blood vessel info starting on page 51. So we're going to tie together blood vessels and blood pressure with cardiac output and heart rate. That's ultimately where we're going to go in here on Thursday. For now, let's lay the foundation with just some basic anatomy. Blood vessels transport blood around the body, and most of them, not all, have three main layers. The layers are called tunics or tunica, and they are named according to their position in the blood vessel. So let's start with tunica intima. That is your innermost lining to the vessel. And we sometimes call it the endothelium because it's a lining just made of epithelial tissue. That endothelium is typically simple squamous. The next layer is the medius layer of this vessel, and it's called the tunica media. It's muscle tissue and elastic fibers. Okay, so the smooth muscle tissue is found here. And what are the elastic fibers good for? Stretch, yep. The outermost layer is called tunica adventitia, or you can call it tunica externa. Like the name implies, externa. It is the outermost of the three layers, and it's collagen fibers. So what do collagen fibers do?
Add structure.
So imagine this. Imagine blood under really high pressure coming through this vessel. The elastic fibers in this middle layer here allow for the stretch of the vessel. But the collagen fibers are like steel cables that wrap the outer surface of this vessel, and they prevent an overstretch of the vessel. So they do provide a scaffolding or a structure on the outside. If you have really high pressure, what can happen to your vessel? Blow it out, rupture it, yeah. So you want to have healthy collagen out there to allow for the stretch, but not too much stretch of those vessels. You know, as we age, vessels wear out, just like tires and rubber bands do. They lose their stretch. And of course, if those collagen fibers aren't giving a good grip on the outside, then vessels can stretch and blow out, like you said. So that's not good news. Also, if we're counting on these vessels to constrict back around the blood they're conducting, if they have become worn out and flabby, then we have problems regulating pressure and blood flow to body parts. So that's another part, just a byproduct of aging and having worn out vessels. Now, it is that middle layer, that tunica media with the smooth muscle, that can constrict if necessary. So we call it vasoconstriction if that vessel gets smaller in diameter. You'll see it here on the right. Or that media layer containing the smooth muscle may relax. And if it relaxes, what happens to your vessel? It dilates, right? So when the vessel relaxes, it opens up and it lets more blood flow through. It's just like us. If you're uptight, you're going to constrict and less blood can go through and the pressure goes higher. If you're relaxed, your vessels open up, more blood goes through, blood pressure goes down. Okay, so ultimately, this is gonna lead to our conversation about blood pressure. Vasoconstriction means we tighten the vessel, the diameter is smaller, the blood pressure increases. Flip it the other way. If you're relaxed, vessels open up, the vessel dilates, and what now happens to blood pressure?
It's down.
It goes down, right. So this is where we're headed with this conversation about vessel diameter. Let's talk about arteries for just a moment. A for arteries and A for away is a good way to remember them. They always carry blood away from the heart. Most of the time, it's what type of blood?
Oxygenated.
It's mostly oxygenated. We've got a couple of exceptions, right? We've got the pulmonary arteries and pulmonary veins. Of course, pulmonary arteries carry what type of blood?
Deoxygenated.
Now, these vessels tend to have a thicker tunica media. Where is tunica media found within a vessel? It's the middle. And what type of tissue is in there?
Muscular.
Yeah. And what kind of fibers?
Elastic.
Elastic fibers. So we've got the muscle tissue, which can contract and constrict the vessel, and the elastic fibers can allow for that stretch of the vessel. Models color them red because, of course, we think of oxygenated blood as red. But in our bodies, all blood is red. It's either bright red or dark red. But nonetheless, models have it colored red. Let me mention to you the difference between elastic arteries and muscular arteries. So elastic arteries tend to be thicker walled. The name implies they have more elastin. What's elastin good for?
Stretching.
And like any rubber band, you not only want it to stretch, but you want it to do what?
Contract,
right? We want it to snap back and contract. So it's not muscle tissue. I do want to clarify here. Muscle tissue responds to messages to contract. But with elastic fibers, we expect for them to stretch and then just pop back into position. So that's going to lead to a good, strong, healthy artery. We think of elastic arteries as conducting arteries. What this means is they're closest to your heart, and they're going to withstand the highest pressures you've got. Look at these examples. Aorta, pulmonary trunk, coronary arteries, common carotid, subclavian. These are, what's that?
The big boys.
The big boys, yeah. They got to have the stretch ability and the ability to snap back if necessary. The muscular ones, like the name implies, well, they're more muscle than they are elasticity. They do carry blood to a particular body part. Their names are usually named for the body part. So if we're talking about the femoral artery, it's got a name for where it's located. It's going to be a muscular artery. Radial arteries, popliteal, tibial, any of these that have a name location are going to be muscular in nature. Okay, so the ones further away from the heart are tending to be our muscular arteries. So which can contract under nervous system stimulation? Muscle tissue or elastic fibers?
Muscle.
Muscle, right. So if you want to restrict or increase blood flow to a body part, you do it by telling the muscle and the muscular tissues to either relax and open up or to contract and constrict that vessel's diameter. You really don't have as much capability to do that around the heart because the pressure is so high. So since these muscular arteries are pulsating with the flow of blood, they are great places to detect our pulse. In fact, we consider many of these muscular arteries our pulse points. Anybody want to snap a picture of this before we move on? Anybody else good to go? All right. So one great pulse point is your wrist. What artery is there?
Radial.
Good. And I want to show you this trick here. They're using two fingers, which is one way to do it. You are using one finger to block the flow of blood through the vessel, and then the second finger is resting lightly because the blood turbulates up against that closed-off vessel. So it's just like taking a hose in your yard and squeezing it. All the water is backed up behind, and it's turbulating up against that closed-off point. When your heart beats, it sends blood ramming against where you have closed off that vessel. And if your heart's beating 75 beats per minute, you're going to feel a pulse every time blood is rammed up against that closed spot. when I went on a beta blocker 10 years ago, I found that this method of using two fingers wasn't really effective because my heart rate had decreased and it was hard to feel with two. So three fingers can also work. And again, use one finger to close off the vessel and then gently place the other two fingers there to feel the blood turbulate up against where that vessel has been closed. You can use this trick in any vessel that's got a pulse, not just here, but where else do you have pulse points? Carotids in your neck, ankles, femoral. You've even got one at the apex of the heart, but don't use your thumb. Why not the thumb?
Feel your own,
right? Okay, so you've got multiple pulse points around the body for these muscular arteries. They're named for the location that they're taking that blood to. So just to kind of show you the difference, look at all these squiggly elastic fibers and these elastic arteries. These are the ones closest to the heart. And you can see this one's relaxed. That's why it looks kind of like, you know, elastic rubber band or underwear. This is a muscular artery. Hey, notice no squiggles. Let's go back. See all these squiggly elastic fibers? Don't really see them here in the muscular artery. All you see is smooth muscle tissue here. Okay? And that's because these muscular arteries are better built for restricting or increasing blood flow to particular body parts. So a lot of squiggly elastic fibers up here in this picture, less of them so down here in the muscular artery. All right, let's talk about tiny arteries. That last bullet point, tiny arteries are called arterioles. Arterioles feed into capillary beds. Capillary beds feed into tiny veins called venules. And what do tiny venules feed back into? Back into veins. So let's talk about veins for just a moment. They always return blood back to the heart. They have a thinner tunica media than do our arteries, and that's because we're not really looking at high blood pressure anymore, and we're not looking at restricting or allowing increased blood flow using veins. That job is done by our arteries. So the job of a vein is simply to conduct this blood back to the heart. And the muscle tissue in the tunica media is about making sure the blood gets from the tips of your toes back to your heart, which could be feet away. In models, these are colored blue. It's because most of our veins are deoxygenated. We, of course, have an exception in the heart here. Which veins that feed into the heart carry oxygenated blood? Pulmonary is good. Because our veins operate under such low pressure, they need some things to assist with the return of blood. And at the very bottom of your page, you'll notice they are valves, skeletal muscle activity. We call it the skeletal muscle pump. And we also call it respiratory pump, but that just simply means breathing. So I think all of you are headed into the medical field in some fashion or another, and you're probably looking at a job that puts you on your feet all the time, right? You know, you may be working 12 hours on your feet. If you're standing for a long time, the blood that pulls down in the lower extremities has to get back up to the heart. Otherwise, we reduce our cardiac output. So we've got to have some things that assist with the return of that blood flow. Valves essentially say, hey, if you've made it this far, you're not going to backflow and pull. So our larger veins do have valves, just like in the heart, to prevent the backflow and pulling of blood. But if you stand for a long time and you're doing a lot of heavy-duty lifting and you're putting pressure on those valves, guess what happens to them? They blow out. They fail. So unfortunately, if you happen to have a valve in a vein that's been damaged, the blood can backflow and pull, and it can cause varicose veins. So that means that those valves, those veins have failed, and unfortunately that's not getting milk back to the heart like it should. Let's talk about the smooth muscle activity. If you stand and never move, you're not giving your muscles an opportunity to help pump blood back to the heart. Every time you move, muscles around your valves and your veins actually allow for blood to flow through and head back to the heart. So simply moving about can help increase the blood flow and the return of that venous blood back to the heart, which is good news. And of course, in this picture here, you can see pneumatic leg compression boots. They cut on and cut off for a patient who's just come through surgery, because if we can't stand up and move, what could happen to blood that pools in these legs?
Coagulation,
right. So by allowing for these boots to cut on and cut off, we eventually get that blood to make its way back to the heart. All right, so the last issue there, whoops, let me go back this way. Respiratory pump is our third mechanism for helping blood to return to the heart. You ever had one of those days where you just leave work or you leave school and you just get in your car and go, what have you just done to blood flow? You breathe them, right? And how do you change your demeanor when you're doing this? Do you feel excited or do you feel more relaxed?
Relaxed.
And when you feel more relaxed, you're decreasing the pressure in your thoracic cavity, and blood flows from higher pressure in your legs toward the lower pressure back towards your heart. So if you simply just do a sigh, if you take a deep breath and let it back out, if you're purposely doing meditation or relaxation techniques, these kinds of things make you breathe deeply. That lowers the pressure in your thorax cavity, and that increases the flow of blood back toward the heart. So,
yawning,
yes. Anything that relaxes puts you back in this state of a respiratory pump. So, yeah, do something that makes your breathing slow and deepen. All right, last thing on the bottom of the page there, small veins are called venules, and that'll finish this page for you.